Hello, welcome to a new episode of Over Morrow's Library, a podcast series for the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Today, I'm joined on the podcast not by one, but by two guests. To continue our discussion about shifting identities and movements of consciousness, what we started last time when we talked about the incredible story of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, today I'm joining forces with Isabel Valli, psychiatrist and neuroscientist at the University of Barcelona, and Hugh Lemmy, author of several novels and co-host with Ben Miller of the podcast Bad Gays. Isabel and Hugh, hello. Thank you for coming on our podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, hi.
So, Isabel, let me begin with you. You are a psychiatrist, but you're also interested in magic. And when we looked at the life of Alvar Núñez, we saw that at one point in his story, he became a practicing shaman. And his magic amazingly worked. So he was actually able to cure people. To what extent is magic real? To what extent is it possible that magic has healing powers?
Well, I guess magic and healing have historically been part of the same practice. So let's say someone like Marsilio Ficino was an astrologer and a physician. So this is something that we can find in potentially all cultures. But if we want to think of an example, maybe we can think of tarantism, a phenomenon that the anthropologist Ernesto De Martino studied in southern Italy in the 1960s. So he went to Puglia, the region where this phenomenon occurred, with a team that included physicians, psychiatrists, and other people to understand this particular set of symptoms that some people fell ill with. And so the symptoms were attributed to the bite of a spider. So that's where the name comes from Tarantula Tarantismo. And what he was most interested about was the specific features that included somehow having one region spared from the phenomenon. So the town of Galatina, where the chapel of San Paolo was based, was spared from the phenomenon. And also other features about the recurrence of this rebiting of the spider. But I think what he was most interested in was how this illness was cured. And this illness was cured through a set of practices that included music, dance, and colors. So the people who fell ill were surrounded by most of their community and musicians, and they would dance sometimes for days until the tarantula was too tired, exhausted, or even died. And so under the protection of San Paolo, they would sort of get rid of the illness and be cured. So there are some elements about this that we can sort of think about in terms of the healing powers of some of the elements that he observed. So the healing power of music, the sort of cathartic experience of this long bodily experience of ongoing dance, and the power of having someone entrusted with having the power to heal. So either a shaman, a practitioner, or in this case, the full community of the village surrounding the person and helping them through. And I guess also some form of divinity, a person or a sort of superior being, in this case, Santo Paolo, who would sort of give the person the sort of grace to be freed from the illness. So in this case, like putting all these elements together, we can think of what are the properties of these things that can resemble something that we can see in medicine. And maybe the sort of one powerful example is placebo effects. So we can think that all medical trials, they need a placebo condition to somehow sort of go with the treatment, because it's so powerful that it can't sort of be discarded as a possibility. So in this parallel, I'm not saying that all magic is a placebo effect, but that we don't know what are the powers of the mind. And I guess I recently had, or recently for quite some time, I had long COVID. And at some point I went to see someone who I trusted to ask for advice. They gave me a week-long ritual which I recently did. But I happen to also be reinfected with COVID. And there is some anecdotal evidence that the reinfections can produce an improvement of the long COVID symptoms. So the point is this the resetting of my immune system by the reinfection, or is a magic ritual? And I guess we don't really need to know.
And Hugh, last time when we were looking at Alvar Núñez, Cabeza de Vaca, we saw how he was using Latin as a magical language to heal his patients, who were all among the native people of ancient Florida, so they wouldn't understand Latin. And this leads me to one of your latest books, Unknown Language, published by Ignota. It's a book, in part, about the 12th century German mystic Hildegard von Bingen and her unknown language. So can you please tell us more about Hildegard's unknown language, what it was, and how it enters your novel?
Yeah, the unknown language, or lingua ignota as it was known, is actually something of a misnomer because the languages that currently exist actually doesn't have any grammar as such. It's an alphabet of 23 letters. And of what survives, that we have a glossary of about 1,000 words, all of which are nouns. But it was used, from what we can tell, it was used in the fragments that exist. It was used within Latin sentences, within a Latin grammar. And these 1,000 words were, there is a suggestion of more, but these 1,000 words were a sort of ordering of the universe in a certain way. This glossary was a list that sort of orders creation from starting with new words, starting with God, and working all the way down to the animals, although not mammals for some reason, with the exception of a bat, which she classifies as a bird. But we don't really know what the language was used for. There's been lots of different suggestions. Some suggest that it was used as a form of communication between nuns in the convent of which she was the abbess. Some people suggest that, but on the other hand, after she died, it was clear from the writings of her scribe that the language died with her. So if there was a language that she used to communicate, it doesn't seem that she actually did pass it on to anybody else. I tend to think of it more in the framework of mysticism, because Hildegard was a very important noted mystic. We can only really hint at what it might be. But to me, it sort of ties in with some notion of heresy and the heretical that travels along with the idea of mysticism. What is the difference between a good mystic, a Catholic mystic within the church, and a heretic? It's merely whether one is given the authority of the church, is recognized by the church. We can see all these other heretical movements as just other forms of mystical Christianity that existed outside of the church. And she was lucky to be accepted within the sort of church infrastructure and within the church politics as an authentic mystic. But within the nature of mysticism is the problem of language, because mystical beliefs are experiential by their nature, and translating them into a written form has to be this sort of quite literal translation, a putting down into words of this experiential moment. And so I wonder whether hers were part of that same form of like trying to find a language that can be understood outside of the church Latin, and therefore maybe ties in with the thing that she has in common with a lot of heretical movements of the time of the medieval period, which is the vernacular, finding a language to express and talk about a relationship with God that exists outside of the Latin. And that's sort of the way I approached it in some ways in the book, which was an attempt to make her visions, which are fascinating and rich, but in the way they're written, they're not super accessible for a modern audience, is to translate this into a novel form, which would make that work more accessible. And so in the same way, I use these forms of nouns to create a world within the book. So the book is intentionally very heavy in using nouns as descriptors, in trying to create a sense of place, of time, and a time which is both located in a specific period of time and totally timeless, that allows you to exist within both a medieval imagination and a imagination of the future through the use of of nouns as descriptors, which is how I approached this sort of way of suggesting something that's both familiar and foreign within her work.
Isabel, to remain on the liminal areas of psychiatry, one aspect of your research touches the relationship between drugs, and I mean illegal drugs, and mental illness. Of course, when we look at shamanic practices, what we today define as drugs are often quite present. But when we discuss the role of drugs today and their impact in terms of increasing mental illness, it's usually in terms of how they increase mental illness. But do they have any other impact on mental illness? And can they perhaps help us to understand the nature of what mental illness fundamentally is?
Yeah, sure. I guess the sort of first example that comes to mind is cannabis, because it's, of all substances, the one that has the strongest relationship with increasing risk of psychosis. And this is something that has been shown to be specifically greater for high potency cannabis. So cannabis has a high concentration of THC and low concentration of other cannabinoids, but especially CBD. So the risk is not the same for everyone. People who have a genetic predisposition would be more prone, and younger people who are still going maturational changes in the brain that make them more vulnerable are more prone to having cannabis as a contributor to developing psychosis. But the interesting thing is that recently cannabidiol is being sort of looked into in terms of the potential therapeutic effects for a number of conditions, and including psychosis. So is something that at the moment doesn't have strong evidence, but there are some investigations looking at whether we can even use this as a contributor to a treatment to reduce the symptoms or even reduce the proneness of some people to develop a psychotic disorder. And other examples are, for example, ketamine, which is a substance that, yes, can help us understand some of the features of psychiatric disorders, because it's used to mimic psychosis in experimental conditions, because, I mean, I guess recreationally it would be called K-holing, but in research is something that is used to understand the mechanisms of psychosis. But at different doses and in different circumstances, ketamine is being used to treat treatment-resistant depression. So this is something that I wouldn't suggest do it at home, because, of course, it's done under sort of strict medical supervision. Yes, I think it's like an area of intense research at the moment, looking at some substances that on some respect have been seen as recreational substances, but they can also have some therapeutic effects.
Moving on to something a bit different, but still in the story of Álvar Núñez, the problem of identity, and especially the fact that he didn't have any particular identity, especially by the time he arrived back to the people that he supposedly belonged to. And Hugh, in some of your work, there is an element of a strange relationship with the question of identity. I'm thinking about your earlier novels, but also maybe the new book coming out with Verso, Bad Gaze. You seem to treat this big topic today in a particular way. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a bit how you see the question of identity today, politically, but also as a writer.
Well, that's a huge question. I think I'd start by saying, like, my interest in identity comes from, I guess, recentering myself as a subject and my experiences as things that influence a constantly fluctuating concept of my own identity, especially around sexuality and gender. And that rather from a starting position of sort of theorizing it, I'm more interested in the way that events and sexual encounters reshape the way I think about them post facto. Like after something's happened, it makes me rethink my behavior and identity as it existed before. And then so in a certain way, one sense of self is reformulated through these sort of experiences rather than being fixed, which I guess perhaps puts a little bit counter to some of the more liberal understandings of identity in post-liberation movements in terms of sexuality, to sort of caricaturize it a little bit, this sort of a born this way concept of sexual identity, that actually sexual identity is always fluid, and not always fluid, but is always shapeable or malleable, through a conscious and unconscious process. And therefore, in my books about sex specifically, Chubbs and Red Tory, the constant tension is between the subjective and the objective world in relationship towards sexuality, and the way that sort of mystical or other experiences and phenomenons in the wider world help shape the sort of sexuality and sexual discourse of the person who's experiencing them, which for me is like a big part of it. And especially in Red Tory, it's specifically about the way that psychedelics can reshape the idea of a political sexual identity rather than just an experiential one. So that actually that my concepts or my feelings around my identity as a political subject are shaped quite literally by sex. And so I guess within that sort of post-liberation concept of homosexuality especially, and certain types of queerness, I would like to recenter the idea of a specific sexual experience as being an intrinsic part of sexuality, which sounds perhaps ridiculous, but actually as this political movement has developed in certain directions, there can be a sense of a new moralism around sex being at the core of sexual identity. And actually the discussions around sexual identity very infrequently in a popular discourse around this that I encounter, and I'm sure there's obviously there's various other experiences, but that quite often that sex is entirely absent from that discussion within sexual identity, that the techniques of sex, you know, what is being put where and how that makes you feel and what comes out of where and et cetera, and how you feel in those positions actually is the thing we should be discussing as like a core to our sexual identity. How do I feel to be in these power relationships or experiencing this physical sensual sensation of these sort of things, and how does that shape me as a political subject? But as I'm not a theorist, as I have very little space in my brain for thinking in a theoretical sense outside of those things, I explore those things in my own life through writing about them in fiction.
And talking about things that are very rigid nowadays, definitely for most people you are born this way, nationalities. Nationalities are somehow very rigid, and both of you, in this case, are currently or have been migrants and foreigners, especially where you are right now. So, Hugh, you are a non-European living in Spain. and Isabel, you love living abroad. Your own background is multinational. In the case of Álvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, he's a foreigner in a foreign land speaking a foreign language. But the Christian mystic of the 12th century, Hugh of St. Victor, famously remarked that the perfect person is that for whom the whole world is a foreign land. But in your case, I would like to ask you both, what's your experience of foreignness, especially in today's context of restricted mobility? And I'm not referring to the pandemic, of course, for restricted mobility, but to borders. And if and how this notion of foreignness informs your work?
Well, I guess, so going back to psychosis, migration is one of the main risk factors for psychosis. So it's something that increases someone's vulnerability, and it's somehow reduced. Let's say if I move to London, to an area where there's no one of my same background, is higher than if I move to London in an area where there is a strong community of, let's say, my same sort of place of origin. So I guess this distinction speaks about the difficulties that we encounter in terms of like all the traumatic elements that come with sort of moving to a place where one is an alien, and therefore to counteract that, the importance of having networks of support, also creating sort of new families, new sort of groups of people that are somehow sort of reducing that sort of difficult experience of being alone in a new place.
For me, I'd count what you said about me not being a non-European. I know that's a little Brexit dig from you, but I guess that situation actually has made me really think about what nationality is and how it affects things. And actually, I do think of myself as extremely Western European and within a Western European discourse. And so moving to somewhere else in Western Europe has been quite interesting in terms of like discovering what is foreign about myself in this situation and what isn't. I suppose primarily in my relationship with the States, the degree to which I'm foreign within the States, which is in my relation with the state, which is not very foreign at all, when I see myself in comparison to other foreigners living in this city who is treated by the state and by the rest, sometimes by the rest of the population, as very foreign. And so realizing, you know, that, like, for example, that race and class really build into that conception of what is to be foreign, what is to be part of a nation. And then secondly, the importance of language in the feeling of foreignness, and that for me, I've really struggled to learn the language. And I found that very alienating for myself, that to be in a situation where someone who exists so much in like a, thinks of myself in a literary framework and a written framework and a verbal framework, to suddenly no longer have the tool of language in a way that you want to, which and the amount of effort that it takes to put, you know, to learn, and having almost admiration for multilingual people, which is as a British person is like rare. And secondly, that the difference in terms of the layers of discourse in terms of being foreign, how do I mean this? There's an accentuation of that linguistic thing as well, thanks to being online. So they have a certain sense of foreignness that occurs in a day-to-day sense based around language. And being excluded or self-excluding from that sort of world because I haven't learned, you know, it took me a while to grasp the language. And yet at the same time, still being able to exist within this different layer of discourse that comes from having an online world. So that actually, in some ways, there's a whole cultural world that I just packed up in a suitcase and brought with me and reopened here and still exist within, which is exactly this sort of scenario of these sort of conversations that we would have previously had in London, now we have from a distance. And that so that I exist again, like on a separate level where I'm still not foreign, because in a sort of linguistic and cultural sense, I still exist within that sort of Anglophone, London-centered sort of cultural world. And therefore another level of trying to integrate within a separate culture, which again is based around language, and have the same conversations or have different conversations in the language of the country I live in, an unknown language, as it were.
Isabel, this problem of foreignness and identity leads me to another aspect of the story of Alvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca. So he was lost in Florida, and when he finally returned among the Spanish in Mexico, he was met with immediate suspicion. The problem was that he had become something of a hybrid, neither Spanish nor native. His magical arts were also a mix of European and American medicines, religion. I know that you are very familiar with the magical cultures of Central America and the Caribbean. And I would like to ask you if you think that this kind of hybridity, the one that Alvar Núñez had, can still be found in those lands where he used to travel.
I guess I'm mostly familiar with the religions of the Caribbean. And well, these are, for example, Santeria or Palomonte in Cuba, and Voodoo in Haiti, and Candomblé in Brazil. And the hybridity in these religions did arise as a necessity, because these are all developments of religions that were formerly sort of part of the populations of West Africa. And of course, they came to be transported to the Caribbean by enslaved people who, you know, were forced to sort of be elsewhere. And having been forcibly displaced, they continued their religious practices, but the Spaniards did prohibit them at some point. So to somehow try and continue their worship practices, they kind of adopted some of the Catholic saints that the slave owners would sort of be wanting them to start and follow. And the ones that they chose were the most similar for their characteristics to some of the orishas, the deities. So, for example, Chango is syncretized with Santa Barbara, or Yemaya with Virgen de Regla. And this is something that happened somehow at the beginning as a disguise, so not to be sort of found continuing the religious practice, but then little by little become embedded in the practice and is now an established component of the Santeria religion that we know nowadays. So these hybridities, I guess, began as something that was forced upon the enslaved people, and then I don't know, it remains like a feature that nowadays is normal. So my neighbor who is Cuban yesterday celebrated Yemaya. She's a daughter of Yemaya, so she had a big celebration in the house, and the altar that she put up was for Virgen de Regla, so a particular virgin that is syncretized with Yemaya, who is the goddess of the sea. So I guess is a different sort of path to hybridity, and one that was forceful rather than chosen, and then travels with the people of these lands, even if they move elsewhere. So as opposed to being sort of rejected for it, has become an embedded component of their practice.
Let's move territories here from Central America to Northern Europe. And let's observe another aspect of the story of Álvar Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, which unfortunately has to do with defeat, the total defeat in the case of Álvar Núñez. And I'm afraid, Hugh, this next question is for you. I could have asked it also to myself, to be honest, because we met, for example, many years ago in the anarchist autonomous movement in London, where you were very active as part of many artistic collectives and other things. And that was during the struggles against austerity and the privatization of seemingly every aspect of British life. That political movement, unfortunately, like many others before it, seems to have lost its battle against late capitalism. And my question here is, as I would have asked Álvar Núñez, how do you think it's possible to continue working, fighting, living, or thinking after a defeat that seems to be definitive?
Well, I'd question the idea that we've been defeated. I think I prefer to think of things in terms of, you know, that Marx's old quote about the old mole, revolution being something that's working underground and is pushed down and only to resurface later. That these are consistent, recurring phenomenon of resistance in various ways that emerge. And then the reason I was sort of attracted to that autonomous current that you were so sort of influential in some ways in that sort of moment in sort of spreading some of those ideas from Italy in the 70s and 80s. The reason it was so attractive was because it was a new language that was describing and useful for people to describe their sensation of what was happening after this old language had died. So that's the moment we're going through at the moment. I'm sure that those new languages are starting to emerge, but we're too old to... You know, there's a younger generation, right? So it's an exciting thing as those new languages express different facets of the same sort of political struggle in some ways. But also, I think there's something to do with the idea of survival, like the word survival, the suffix sur comes from super, which means sort of over or beyond. And survival, you know, the word quite literally means to sort of continue after the death of something. And that was what, in one thing that attracted me about Hildegard, and I reuse as a concept in the novel, is what's it mean to survive the end of the world? That there's a recurring phenomenon throughout history of people do survive apocalypses. Entire cultures, communities, worldviews can fall apart, but human beings can survive through that. And I guess in that concept, I think, really ties in again to what we were discussing earlier, maybe about heresy, that heretical movements are consistently suppressed, but they're fighting for some sort of necessary response to the situation in which they live in. Unless the circumstances change, simply new iterations against those old oppressions resurface. And the Catholic Church can work for 1,000 years to suppress, for example, the language and the access to a mystical or direct relationship with God through language, as it did. But eventually, there's stop traction, it happens, and things are reformed and things change.
You mentioned apocalypses and ends of worlds, and this is also the topic of this podcast series, which is about creating a virtual library for the day after tomorrow. So a collection of books that might help people, some of whom might be the young people you were referring to experience the end of a certain world and the beginning of another world, which is always a trauma. So one last question for you both. As it's customary every time we have a guest here, I would like to ask you if you could contribute to the shelves of our library with a few books that you think we should miss.
For me, the book would be The Pursuit of the Millennium by Norman Cohen, which is a sort of magisterial history book from the 1950s that accounts exactly these sort of stories I was talking about in terms of heretical movements in medieval Europe. And really, reading the book is opening a door to a dead world, but or a million dead worlds. These things that shaped our world that you've never heard about before. These trends, these threads that were cut and never to be picked up again. And he sort of pulls these threads back together and ties them together so you can understand the influence that heretical movements had in Western Europe and in Central Europe in the development of contra histories of Christianity. And then from that, obviously, there's so many aspects of that in relationship towards both mystical experience and prophecy that are fundamental parts of all human culture, I think. And there's so many lessons that you can learn from that. And recently, listening to a sort of podcast, which is a history of the QAnon movement, I was really struck by the fact that I was like, I've heard this before. This is not a conspiracy theory. This has some other sort of model of understanding it. And I was like, oh, this is a heretical movement with the prophecy of the returning, in medieval Christianity in Europe, it was Baldwin X, who died in the Crusades and was a constant figure who was supposed to come back and save us from this situation, or who now is this JFK Jr. figure, for example, or Trump, for example, as the leader of the heretical movement, who says we must, the only way to change society is like to a clean sweep of the corrupt old elite and stuff. So that book for me is something that's really structured my thought about so much to do with politics, religion, belief and mysticism ever since.
I would probably include The Divan of Hafez, the Iranian poet. And the reason is that this is a book that is used for bibliomancy. So a practice where you can open the book at a random point to ask a question or to know about the future. And this is a practice that has, other books being used. For example, in Roman times, this practice was called sortes, and it would be either sortes homericae, if they used the Iliad specifically, or sortes virgiliane, and there was also sortes sanctorum, if they used the Bible itself. But I guess I use this one because it's used nowadays, and because I've used it myself, and I would recommend if you use it, follow the advice. I didn't, and it wasn't a good idea. I thought I would like to add a book that can be used for divination.
Thank you. And dear Isabel and Hugh, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, and thank you for coming on our podcast. And well, I hope also the listeners will continue to stay with us for the next episode of Over Morrow's Library, still here at the Center of Contemporary Arts in Geneva. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.